Welcome to the Snowfighters Institute podcast, featuring conversations with leaders in professional snow and ice management about what's working, what's challenging, and what matters most in our industry. Here's your host, Phil Harwood.
Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of the Snowfighters Institute podcast. I am Phil Harwood, the host of this podcast, and I'm very excited today to have someone who I've heard about many, many times over the years and have the utmost respect for, has a great reputation in the industry. He's worked with a lot of the companies that I've done consulting work, and I've just heard so many great things. So I'm really excited today to have Josh Ferguson with us. Do you go by Esquire, Josh?
I don't. No need for that.
Okay. All right. That's always a debate during law school, right? Are you going to go with the Esquire or not? But you're an attorney and partner at Freeman, Mathis & Gary LLP based in Philadelphia. Is that right, Josh?
That's it. Yep.
Thank you so much for being here. This is amazing. I can't wait to get into our conversation.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Well, let's start with your legal practice. I mean, you're an attorney and you've been in the industry for so many years, and I know you work in other, I shouldn't assume, do you work in other, what industries do you work in? Because I know you're very involved in the snow industry, but do you kind of get into all industries or do you focus on service businesses or how does that work?
Yeah. So at my core, I'm an insurance defense attorney. So I've been doing that for 22 years. And what that historically looks like is what if a lawsuit gets filed against an insured company, whether that's a construction defect claim or a personal injury claim, and that insurance company sends it over to me or my law firm, we would defend them. So it can really run the gamut on a negligent security case against a bar or restaurant, or a construction company for a site issue where somebody gets hurt or there's damage to a site. But over the years, I have sort of developed a bit of a niche in the snow and ice management landscape, pavement maintenance section. So I do tend to get more of those claims for sure from the carriers and then develop the relationships directly with the contractors that you and I were just talking about. So I get some of those that work directly. So to answer your question, it still can run the gamut, but the vast majority of the work that myself and my team here in Philadelphia at least do is representing contractors, specifically snow and ice and landscape.
Okay, awesome. And that legal work can be done nationwide, is that correct?
It can, yeah. I mean, I've been with my firm, Freeman, Mathis & Gary, now for 10 years, and I specifically joined this firm because we have a national platform. So I sit here in Philadelphia, City Hall's right behind me where I've tried several cases, and I'm admitted in New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and Maryland, but I have colleagues that specifically work in these industries across the United States. So I can assist and consult about specialty issues, but I have people in all those states that try lots of cases for me and my clients.
Yeah. Okay. Awesome. So I want to delve deeper into some of the legal issues that are pertinent today, but I also just want to take a minute and talk about your background and what inspired you to become an attorney. Did you just, when you were 5 years old, you're like, I want to be a lawyer. Like, when does that switch go on?
Yeah. I don't know if there was a specific moment. My dad certainly thinks there was, and it was just about how, what an early age I began to argue with my parents. Nice. and not give them an inch. And what's really interesting about that is I certainly never thought much about that, but when you meet other attorneys, and I've been to conferences that are held by attorneys, that seems to be the number one thing that identified an attorney versus a non-attorney is their willingness to argue early on with their parents. So I do think identified, that early on, the negotiation and arguing standpoint is maybe a good pathway for me. And then in undergrad, I went to Old Dominion University in Norfolk, Virginia, and I took an intro to law class, and the professor was a local practitioner, kind of shingle guy that did a little bit of everything. I just loved what his day looked like and how varied it was and his relationship development with clients, but then the opportunity to go into court for this, institution of the legal world, which, goes back to our forefathers. And it really spoke to me. And I just knew from that moment I was eventually going to go to law school and practice and hopefully try cases.
Nice. And where did you go to law school?
I went to Widener University, which is also sometimes identified as Delaware School of Law in Wilmington, Delaware.
Oh, okay. Nice. Awesome. Yeah, I've heard that quite a bit about the kind of proclivity to engage in arguments and debate, mix it up with the family is a good, precursor to going to law school,
For sure.
becoming an attorney. Certainly, if you want to be a litigator, I'm assuming you work a lot. A lot of attorneys do because we enjoy our work. But what do you do outside of work? What are some of your hobbies?
Yeah, we certainly do put in the hours, but really want to strike the work-life balance. So my wife and daughter and I live just outside of Center City, Philadelphia. We certainly like to be outdoorsy. My 13-year-old plays lots of sports, and I help coach some of them. I also have developed a bit of an adventure bug. So over the years, I've run a lot of marathons, and my childhood best friend and my brother and I have done some fun adventure races like Grand Canyon Rim to Rim to Rim, which was a 50-miler
Wow.
over the course of a little over a day. Again, just to try to have something to look forward to and stay in shape as I come closer to 50.
Right. How do you prepare for 50 miles in a day? That sounds insane.
Yeah, it's certainly a challenge. It involves both getting the distance in, but also for something like Grand Canyon that had 20,000 feet of elevation change, trying to find
Oh my
hills
gosh.
or people may know the Rocky movies with the art steps. At the time I did that, we were living right by the art museum, so I ran those Rocky steps by the art museum an awful lot to try to get some
Oh, that is so
try to
cool.
build up the strength. So
Yeah. And I can only imagine what the scenery was like in that rim to rim run.
it was
Just
beautiful. Yeah.
must have been inspiring. Yeah. Wow. I always like to be ask people on these podcasts, since we're talking about snow, whether they love or hate snow, because it seems like snow is very polarizing for some reason. So and maybe that question is a maybe that your answer is different today than it was when you were a kid, but what side are you on?
Yeah, you know what? I think it's the same answer, but just from a different perspective. I certainly loved it as a child. I certainly like looking at it now. I'm not sure I love the cold. I think it's the ironic joke of someone who specializes in the snow and ice management industry is I really can't wait till my daughter gets to college and I spend most of the winter somewhere warm. But I do love to look at it, and I do think about the fact that when it snows real well, some of the folks listening to this are that's when they're hopefully doing really well financially for their company. So sure, for the most part, I like it as long as I don't get stuck in it too long.
All right, fair enough. Well, we're coming off a winter where we've had another salt shortage, and we've had several of these throughout my career. I think the first really serious one was, I think it was 2009, is that right? The whole industry kind of freaked out, and that's when people very first started talking about liquid de-icing on a pretty serious basis. And that whole side of the business started to develop. But coming off a salt shortage, a lot of the questions I was being asked is, things like, well, not only where can I buy salt, but how do I deal with my clients? I have this obligation, my contracts to, put down materials that I don't have access to. I have liability, I have risk. My clients don't really want to hear that, there's some shortage. They don't care. So how do you advise your clients when they're asking you those questions? How can contractors protect themselves when they don't have the stuff they have to put down?
You're right. It's certainly been a repeat. This feels like this is the third or fourth time, as you mentioned, in the last 15 plus years, we've had some issues with that. And almost every question my guest you're going to ask today is going to have two aspects to it. The first one is what can you put in your contract to help protect yourself? And then how can you document the follow-up issue when you actually experience it? From a contract perspective, I think most folks have heard of force majeure or act of God clause in an agreement. What we have done over the years as these salt shortages have happened is we've specifically identified salt shortage in the same way that you identify an otherwise act of God. And so if there is a salt shortage, you are not responsible as a result of it for certain obligations in the agreement, which is like how much to put down. And then the liability that is related to that from an exposure perspective. So that's one area that we try to wrap it in. We certainly try to wrap it into the contract in other areas where we're limiting your overall liability and exposure. But then the second component to it is when you actually experience the salt shortage, there should be some communication that's documented and you have some kind of proof as to the actual shortage. So hopefully, one, notifying your client of the shortage, and then two, having some evidence of it, like the facilities that you're obtaining the salt from, or if you're one of those folks that goes directly over to Europe to a mine or North Africa, wherever it is, you have some documentation so that if it's related to a claim from your client down the road, or a personal injury lawsuit 2 or 3 years down the road, you have that documentation to prove, one, that there was in fact a shortage, not just what you're saying, and two, that your contract provides you some liability protection. So if you have those two things in combination, you should be in pretty good shape.
Yeah. Okay, awesome. Is that true for other exigent circumstances that contractors face in the snow and ice industry, such as, you know, things like drifting or ice storms or things that normally wouldn't be included in, you know, a plowing contract, right? Or do those need special language?
Yeah, I would, for those examples, we would carve out specific sections in the agreement, which we typically do for drifting, for snow banks. We often see lawsuits where we believe at least the snow is as a result of coming off a roof. And we obviously see issues with defective site conditions, broken downspouts or gutters, depressions, blocked drainage, all kinds of issues could arise on the site. And those should be specifically identified in the agreement. And again, these are site conditions / acts of God. And as you mentioned, what you said kind of are that in between. But if we can identify those things in the agreement, it's just not your responsibility. And then again, we hopefully have some documentation and evidence to prove it, from pre-inspection site maps to show where it likely drifts to, or in event documentation to say to the client, this is actually happening, and then you store that so we can use it down the road. When you have that combination of things with the protective contract language and then the communication documentation that's documented and stored in a way that can be seen and used down the road, that's really how you protect yourself best.
So my follow-up to this, Josh, is if we have our contract perfect, because we've worked with you and it's all tricked out, it's got all the language we need in it, but then we're faced to sign the customer's contract and it doesn't have any of that language in it, now what? Now what? How do we approach this?
Yeah, I mean, it's ultimately why we call this risk mitigation, not risk removal, because they could sign your contract and there are still some exposure points, because the legal world is an imperfect system and you're at the mercy of judges and juries. But in this specific situation where you're being asked to sign the client contract, the best thing we can own is a red pen. We try to mark up that agreement the best we can. And then the strategic tip and trick we typically do is we recommend approaching your client and saying, we understand you have an agreement, likely the same agreement you send to every other contractor under the sun. You've retained us because we're the specialty in this industry. We'd like to at least attach our contract to focus on the scope of work as an addendum to your agreement. And then when they say yes, which happens, I think, more often than not from my experience, we're then attaching ours as the exhibit, which has not only the scope of work, but some of this protective language. So we're able to, again, move it in the right direction, right? We're talking about a spectrum here, and it's hard to be perfect. As an attorney, I want the stars, the sun, and the moon, and I don't always get it. But if we can move it in a better direction, and this is an example of that, if you can get some of the protective language in, hopefully it balances out it. When you have good documentation management protocols and procedures, it will increase your protection level and allow us and your insurance company to fight those claims.
So when it comes to the red pen markup process, do you find that snow contractors have the ability to do that themselves? Or are they reaching out to you and are you doing that for them? Are you engaging in direct conversations with your client's, or are you working with your client to kind of coach them through that?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of options, but to answer the question, I do a ton of it. And I am very busy from about mid-September to mid-November every year for the snow and ice management contractors. Sometimes earlier for those that are super proactive, but I do a lot of it. And it can look like all ways, shapes, and forms. Certainly contractors that have maybe small sites with not much exposure might not send those contracts to me, but they send the more concerning ones. Or I have contractors I've worked with for so many years that they have learned through me some of the exposure points. And so they mark it up themselves and they may send it to me saying, hey, did these markups look good? There's always shapes and forms, but I certainly get involved. And if anything else, I just want to educate to where the exposure points are. Because look, at the end of the day, if we mark up an agreement and the client wholly rejects it all, you still got the benefit of now understanding the risk that you have. Because if you just blanketly sign every agreement, you honestly don't understand your exposure points. So there's a benefit on every occasion to reviewing the contract and identifying those exposures and what it means to you and your company.
Yeah. Okay, awesome. I want to move on to a slightly different topic here, but maybe still concerning salt a little bit. Are you getting involved in any environmental or regulatory kind of legislative issues surrounding salt usage? Certainly around the East Coast there, where everything ends up in a water course going to the ocean. Are you seeing some of that, or is that really faded into the background more recently?
Yeah, we certainly had a stretch, maybe pre-pandemic, where a few states instituted some restrictions on salt usage, types of salt. And then there was a break, and we've actually seen an uptick in some states that have presented, at least to the governor or the legislature, an interest in doing that. And so I do think we're back in that direction as the environmental concerns about a variety of things kind of hit the fan. As we've started to see concerns about forever chemicals and microplastics, I do think it triggers folks to say, what else are exposure points? And I do think the studies are concerning for folks about that. So I do think we're going to continue to see the uptick in that. Mm-hmm. And then we have to ask on the other side, okay, if we need to plan for that in our state based on the legislature's interest, at least, how can we protect ourselves from that?
Mm-hmm. Okay, got it. Thank you. So you do litigation. You represent clients in defense of claims. What are some of the really things that stand out, the key points that contractors should really be aware of to be more proactive, to try to better position themselves when they do find themselves having to defend a claim? You know, are there some top two or three things that really stand out to you?
Yeah, for sure. So I think when a claim comes in the door from an insurance company to asking us to represent, John Plow Truck, and we get the file, what the carrier is asking us is, how defensible is the case? How good or bad is this contractor going to look, right? Because we're talking about optics and credibility in front of a judge and jury. And then how much is it going to cost us, you, to defend, are we going to have to pay you to defend the case? And unless they've got a good contractor with good documentation, they are much more likely to veer on the side of the follow-up question being to us, okay, call that plaintiff's counsel and find out what their demand is, and let's see if we can resolve it, right? Mm-hmm. Insurance companies aren't in the business of screwing over their insureds, but they are in the business of assessing risk and getting out of it. And if they're going to have to pay a defense attorney $50,000 to defend a case, and they can settle it for $40,000, and there's not a good contractor, there's no contract, there's very limited service documentation, they are unlikely to put that in the hands of a jury. So what can we do on the contractor side to put it in the hands of a defense attorney that says, I got a good contractor that does everything the right way, let's defend this case? You have a finely tuned contract that identifies your scope of work very narrowly for exactly what you're going to do. And then you have the documentation to back up the preseason documentation. You'll have some kind of site map that identifies where you're going to do the work, where stuff is going to be moved, and any site defects. You've got your in-event documentation that details exactly the who, what, when, where, and how. And then any kind of follow-up, ice watch, or anything else that you do or don't have to do should be documented. When we have all those components, it is so much easier to defend those cases and easier for us as defense counsel to stand up to the carrier and say, let's fight this one.
Hmm. Well, that's a good checklist right there. And I think most contractors I'm aware of have some of that, but they probably don't have all of it. But they're all frustrated when the insurance companies settle. They feel like they're getting, kind of taken advantage of. They're not having an opportunity to be part of that conversation. And is there even an opportunity for them? Is there a way for them to get their comments in, get their input in? Or is this just a very quick process that insurance companies handle without the client?
Yeah. I mean, I look, almost all of these lawsuits for negligence claims, which are the slip and fall type cases, these commercial general liability policies do not have a consent clause. Mm-hmm. So the carriers can just settle it out. How, that being said, the active contractors, the ones that are involved in the process, that are talking to the insurance carrier and the claim professional, that are constantly communicating with the attorney defending the case, it's a classic squeaky wheel gets the grease. If you stay involved in the process, it does a bunch of stuff. One, it shows them that they've got a contractor who's going to be involved and maybe will be good to testify, good at depositions. Mm-hmm. Two, again, people are going to be more alert to that. And so I do think while you ultimately don't have the final say, those that are involved in the process, I can speak from experience, are much more likely to get the results that they want. And maybe not every case, but cumulatively, if over your career you have 10 lawsuits, you're going to get benefits in those over the majority of those. If you stay involved in the process, if you get them the documentation they need and you stay involved.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it totally makes sense. As you were talking, I was thinking about contractors that heavily use subcontractors and what do they need to be thinking about here?
Yeah. I mean, the biggest exposure point from an insurance carrier is not all the stuff that we've actually talked about so far, but other than the cost of defense, right? And if a lot of both your original contract and then your subcontract involves a transfer of risk, which is the defense and indemnity provisions in those agreements and the additional insured obligations. So first and foremost, even if you don't have a subcontractor, if you're just the contractor, you want to try to limit the scope of what you might owe to the property owner and property manager. As I talked about before, those insurance companies are really interested in knowing how much it's going to cost to defend a case. And I was just talking originally about how much it's cost to just defend you as the contractor. But if you then owe defense and indemnity to your client, but you guys might be pointing the fingers at each other because of, say, a site defect, or you're quabbling over whether you were supposed to be at the site or not, your insurance company might still have to pick up their defense but have two separate defense attorneys. So their cost of defense might be double what they would ever even pay this plaintiff. So then when we're talking about you subcontracting the work, you need to make sure you're passing down all the exposures. So you're not just passing down your liability, but your client's liability. And you're making sure that your subcontractor is naming not only you, but your client as an additional insured, because you want to protect that all the way down the pipeline. Mm. And so where I see good contractors get themselves in trouble is that every contract with their client might be slightly different, but they've got this uniform subcontractor agreement. And we need to have two documents that when you put them against each other, mirror each other. If there's gaps, that's where the exposure might be.
Got it. Okay. Totally makes sense. In the snow industry, something really bad happens, right? We're out at night, we're in conditions, it's dark, people are tired. I've spent hours and hours out on the road plowing snow and being part of operations. We're distracted. We're not thinking clearly sometimes. So when there's an emergency or maybe even a catastrophic situation, someone calls you, like how available are you and how do you respond to those emergencies?
Yeah, we have an emergency response team that was originally created because we do a fair amount of commercial trucking work. And as anyone can identify, the larger the vehicle, the more likely catastrophic an incident is. We've transitioned that the same to almost all of our other fields, and I certainly have applied that to our construction, pavement maintenance, and snow and ice management, because we've got larger pieces of equipment that can do heavy damage both to property and to people. And so, yeah, we are responsive any time of the day. We would respond to sites within hours, oftentimes with our experts in tow, because it has a lot of value for us to see exactly the way a site and condition looks as quickly as we can, especially for a catastrophic lost claim, both for us to put eyeballs on it, our expert to put eyeballs on it, but also when we're out there, then there's some protection from privilege as an attorney client so that we can have conversations with the driver, with your site manager, with folks to kind of protect that privilege, to make sure someone doesn't say something silly and that we have control of the situation. So I think that's really important. On almost any size claim, the sooner that you notify the folks that potentially are going to be involved in the process, the better it is, right? Because witnesses minds change, information changes, people disappear, texts disappear, and those are all very problematic down the line.
Right. Wow, that's great to know. I had no idea you guys were set up that way. That's cool. Is there anything else I want to kind of shift gears and talk about the industry kind of generally? Is there anything else you want to share about your legal practice? I know you do a lot of counsel, general counsel type work. Can you talk about that?
Sure. Yeah. So I serve as outside general counsel for a variety of contractors and trade associations. And again, the fields we've been talking about, snow and ice management primarily, but also landscape, pavement maintenance, power sweeping. What that looks like on the general counsel side for clients is it's typically for those contractors that are not of the size where they're large enough to have and retain on their staff an attorney. And so we are available as needed to answer any question. And so that could be, I've got somebody I want to fire. How do I do it the right way? I've got a contract that needs reviewed. I want to incorporate in a different name. I want to ask questions about whether I can sue a company or my client's threatening to sue me for breach of contract. What does that look like? Again, anything that an in-house attorney would do, we can do and we provide and we do on a pretty consistent basis. And frankly, it's one of my favorite parts about what we do because as a trial defense attorney, we are reacting to something that happened a long time ago and we are dealing with whatever's in front of us. But there is nothing better than being the ounce of prevention. If you're going to do the Ben Franklin quote, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. It's really nice to try to address things at the front proactively to put a company in better shape down the line. And so it's my favorite thing I do. I hope the insurance carrier claims professionals I work with don't listen to this podcast. If they do, I also love your stuff as well. But it provides a lot of value and we love doing it.
Yeah. No, that's great. Thank you for sharing that. So I see your name everywhere. Trade associations, you've been a regular attendee of Snow Fighters Institute, I think probably from the very beginning, right? Were you in Erie, Pennsylvania back in the day when John Allen was running the show?
I've flown into Erie several times for John, yeah.
Nice. Yeah, John was the founder of Snow Fighters Institute. Great guy, still out there doing his thing with his team. But I see you everywhere. So kind of what's the draw? Is it just truly just a place to go find clients or what? Why are you so involved everywhere?
Yeah, no, I mean, that's a great question. I certainly do enjoy it, but it does go back to what I just mentioned a moment ago, that what actually probably brings me the most joy, but not nearly the most money is the proactive general counsel process of working with contractors to put them in better shape. And it is truly, I think, some of the best ROI for contractors as opposed to dealing with it on the backside. I love the relationships that I've built over the years in the industry. So I do feel like I'm going to see my friends when I go to these events, but really it boils down to, I really enjoy the trying to make things better before it happens, as opposed to the reactive trying to create the best puzzle out of the puzzle pieces that exist.
Right. No, I love that. I've always kind of felt the same way. It's been, for me, the industry involvement, even though I've certainly, you know, garnered a lot of business from it, that's really not my main motivation. Really, my motivation has always been to give back and just create those relationships, be valuable, pass on what I know. You know, the old saying, you know, you don't know what you don't know. And I don't know everything, but I know what I know. And I'm happy to educate people and share my experience and help other people get better. And that's just so valuable. It does take a toll going to all these conferences and writing articles and blogging and speaking everywhere. But I enjoy it. And it sounds like you enjoy it as well. And you're right. The relationships are really what really matter at the end of the day and just making a difference in the lives of people. So I love hearing that. Is there anything that you're seeing in the industry that is worth chatting about here? Any trends or any other maybe risk factors that we haven't talked about?
Yeah. You know, something the plaintiff's bar, meaning the attorneys who represent the folks that are filing the lawsuits for property damage or what the big driver, the personal injury claims these days. I mean, everybody's seen obviously the increasing level of billboards in every city you're in. There's triple, quadruple the level of billboards for personal injury claims these days.
They're everywhere.
They're everywhere. And they have really also taken a hold of this slip and fall world. If you went 20 years ago, the good big law firms with really seasoned, experienced trial attorneys weren't really handling these cases. They were sending them to the small law firms, the ones that are on the buses, not on the big billboards. Mm. But we've seen a sea change where those firms are keeping these cases. They're making them much bigger with retention of experts. They are claiming traumatic brain injury claims now instead of a minor concussion, and the injuries are getting ramped up and they're getting more experts to talk about economic loss and all those things. But they're also adding additional arguments, because what they've learned in this industry is that there are multiple tiers, right? You've got a property owner, maybe a property manager, the initial tier contractor, and a subcontractor. And they understand, historically speaking, in that vertical line, it all falls down to the subcontractor. And plaintiff's counsel do much better when there are multiple pots of money available than only one pot of money.
Right.
So they are now adding in all these lawsuits negligent hiring and retention claim. And what that looks like is for the property owner or property manager saying you retained a contractor that was incapable or couldn't perform the services that you retained them for. Or if you're the contractor that retains a subcontractor, you retained a subcontractor that wasn't capable of performing the services for this location. So I'll give you a high level example of somebody trips and falls in a mall complex. And the claim is that that area of the mall was not yet serviced 10 hours after the snowfall completed. It should have been, and it wasn't, because the ultimate contractor just wasn't staffed up properly, wasn't prepared to handle it. So what that negligent hiring and supervision claim would look like, especially versus the contractor, is you retain somebody that just couldn't do the job. And so you would have to have documentation to show that when you retain them, you had some checks and documentation to show that they had the manpower and equipment and history to service a site like that. And if you don't have that, even if you have a perfect subcontract that has additional insured language, their subcontractor carrier may defend one part of the claim, but not the other one. And that's exactly what the plaintiff's counsel wants. They want your carrier as the main contractor to be stuck in the case for at least part of it and having to pony up extra money. And so we are seeing that one. And so again, we're talking about document management. Document is usually what people take away from my presentations, and I want you to hear. And this is an added one. Is, again, you need some kind of investigation checklist for your subcontractors to check the box and then store somewhere to show they were capable of servicing the site that you retain them for. They can be negligent. Their driver could have fallen asleep. That's different than them being capable of performing the service.
Correct. Right. Yeah, it goes into the whole independent contractor relationship and, and who bears that risk. Well, that's really fascinating. And I see it. Yeah, you're right. I see those billboards everywhere, and it totally makes sense that they're looking for those other pots of money and adding claims and the documentation. I remember, you know, when I was pre-consultant world, when I was running a snow company, we had a very extensive, methodical hiring process for subcontractors that was all documented. And I think it's exactly what you're talking about. But I know, I would say most contractors I'm aware of don't have those things in place. It's not even on the radar. So this is really huge. So we're recording this a couple days right before Snow Alliance out at Gene Storick's place, Storick's Plows in Leesport, Pennsylvania. And we're going to be together on a panel talking about some of these same issues. I don't want to steal all your thunder here, but is there anything else that you want to chat about that we didn't chat about? This was great, but is there anything else hanging out there before we wrap up?
Yeah, I mean, I always think it's worth highlighting my number one exposure point from a document management policy, even for good contractors. The thing that tends to create headaches in lawsuits is lost or missing text messages. So many folks are now communicating with their clients that way. And where it becomes problematic is when we have these lawsuits, again, 2 to 4 years down the line, and the person who was communicating with the property manager was someone in a truck for you, or your site manager who is now gone, who took his phone with them, and the communication did not service the site or did not do a follow-up ice watch, even though you were recommended it, or for a thaw, refreeze, whatever it is, that text is gone. Not only do we not have it anymore, so we're relying upon credibility to believe you, but it actually has something called a spoliation charge, which means there's an adverse inference against you that whatever that document was, it actually set it against you. So it's been flipped 180. Even if you have document management policies for everything else, folks really need to lock down how they maintain and store electronic documentation such as emails, text communications, even online social media if people are communicating by X or something else. Because that piece of documentation could be the absolute key to a case. If a client turned down site service or changed the scope of site service, if we don't have that documented in some way, it becomes a credibility contest. And that's not what your insurance company are likely to fight a battle over.
Wow. So I'm thinking of, you know, platforms that have texting built into them, like Team Engine, where those texts are stored by the company. They're not on someone's personal cell phone who may just disappear at the end of the season because they're a seasonal employee. That becomes really huge.
Technology has really changed what this all looks like. We could have you and I could have a whole separate hour on technology and the impact on service, claims, all of it. But it really has made life easier if people take advantage of that stuff. It reduces the friction for your employees, as you said, who are out there in the middle of the night doing things. It automates a lot of that. And that way, there's so much more protection that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that might be a good follow-up interview for a future time, but
sure.
Let's leave it there. Josh, thank you so much for being here. This is really wonderful.
My pleasure.
We'll see you soon at Snow Alliance.
Sounds good.
All right. Take care.
Thanks for listening to the Snow Fighters Institute podcast. Subscribe so you don't miss future episodes and check out our upcoming events at snowfightersinstitute.com.